Welcome everybody to our sales lunchtime seminar. We are very fortunate today to have Dr. Annette Nordhausen-Scholz from the University of Manchester, who's going to give a lecture and then engage in a discussion with the audience about behavioral economics and the autonomous consumer. She's an expert in consumer law. She is originally from Northern Germany, so I feel very at home having her here today.
South, from where you come from.
Yes, I'm much further north, actually. She did all her legal qualifications, including her doctorate, in Northern Germany, and then joined the University of Sheffield as a DAAD lecturer, and then later joined the University of Manchester. She is the SLS section convener for EU and competition law. So if you have interesting projects and papers, then you should sort of talk to her. She's also the co-editor of the Yearbook of Consumer Law and has been doing an incredible amount of research on consumer law and e-commerce law. So please welcome Dr. Annette Nordhausen-Scholz.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. It's Scholz, yes.
Yes, sorry.
Don't worry. The topic I'm going to talk about today is one that is quite high up in the European Commission's agenda in thinking on how to change consumer legislation. I'm not entirely in line with the Commission here, though it is an interesting concept. So what I would like to look at today is ask the question whether our current approach in consumer law, in consumer protection, and if I talk about consumer law and consumer protection law here, what I actually mean is consumer contract law. The current approach we have is to give the consumer a lot of information and give the consumer, with that information, the tools so they can make an informed choice. The question that comes again and again back is that the right approach? And the question the Commission is asking at the moment is what role can or should behavioural economics, or the results of behavioural economics, play in consumer policy? So in how far should that influence legislation? First of all, a quick look at the consumers in the market. It would be nice if this would go forward, not backwards. Right. Consumers as a whole play a very important role in the economies. Within the OECD, it's more than 60% of the GDP is consumer transactions. So we have this situation where we have the individual consumer with his rather small transactions, but consumers as a whole are a very important group. The traditional economic theory assumes that the free market will produce best outcome for consumers, and that is the underlying assumption of our current consumer legislation. though it doesn't stop there. Yeah, but that is the starting point. We need to change this free market approach a little bit and tweak it a bit, because market failures can hinder the best outcome. But the emphasis is on competition and consumer information. A working competition means a working market, means best prices, best products for consumers. And if we, I knew that would happen, if we then give the consumer a lot of information so he's got all the tools to make an informed choice. In times like the current ones, market failures become more likely. Markets become more endangered, and therefore also consumer protection in these markets. Our starting point in consumer contract law within the EU is contract law. And there is no EU specific contract law, though we're moving closer and closer towards it. But it's been developed out of the existing contract law systems in all member states. And despite these systems being very different in a lot of respects, the basics of contract law are all the same in all 27 member states. And the basics I've listed there are freedom of contract, party autonomy. Neither of these are stated within EU law as a principle in primary or secondary EU law, but they go back to the legislation and to the legal systems of the member states, and therefore can be seen as a principle in EU law as well. The assumption is that parties are equal, and can bargain about their contract. Consumer law acknowledges that the consumer hasn't got the same bargaining power normally, and that most consumer contracts are between a bigger player, a trader or a producer or whatever, and the individual consumer. And that means that the consumer may not have access to all the information about the product, and therefore the idea of consumer law, as we have it at the moment, is to give the consumer a level playing field, put the consumer in a position so he or she can bargain and is in a position, in an equal position. The other assumption, like I said before, is perfect competitive markets. And just to stop you dreaming too far, the next slide is called Nothing is Perfect. Buyers and sellers in a perfect competitive market are informed about all products, including all prices and attributes. All actors make choices in their own interest. And consumers have got an influence in the market with their collective buyer power. So if consumers are very quality driven, then low quality products will fail in the market. If consumers are price driven, then too high prices won't work. So there is a power consumers as a group have in the market. No impediments to switching suppliers. And products and prices are determined by the market and cannot be influenced by one supplier. So in this ideal world, consumers will get products they want at prices they're willing to pay. But nothing is perfect. The market does fail in certain segments of the market, or may fail overall because of whatever circumstances around it. It could be cartels or something, but it could also be a market that is highly segmented, where there is no consumer power to speak of. And the two approaches to address the market failures are competition law and consumer law. Competition law, of course, has got the two sides. One is to make sure there is a perfect competition. And often a bit as an afterthought, oh, well, consumers benefit from it as well. But this afterthought seems to become a bit more important in competition law. The market failures are always defined starting from the ideal of maximum consumer welfare, but we all know that is not the case. We don't live in an ideal world, so we need to have some corrective legislation to help the consumer and to protect the consumer. But the current approach is very much to do that within the market and not to interfere too much with it, the lowest level of interference we can get away with. Autonomy means that the law assumes a degree of knowledge and attention of all market participants. It's not the nanny state where somebody will look after it. It puts, if we look at consumers, it puts a responsibility onto consumers to look after their own interests, to go out and inform themselves, and not just to go with what comes along. If you think about that in an abstract term, it will be saying, well, some consumers will be more able to do that than others, but a lot of them should be quite able to look after themselves. But then we are all confronted with quite sophisticated marketing, and that's where that often fails. The Court of Justice defines the consumer in slightly varying ways, but that can be distilled down to a reasonably well-informed, attentive and circumspect consumer. If you just stop for a second and think, when you make any purchases and you are in a shop and you see something, or on the internet you see something that looks really wonderful, are you then making sure you are reasonably well informed, attentive and circumspect? Reading all the terms and conditions, making sure you understand what the delivery costs are, whether you can send it back, and all those things? Not always. So this ideal the Court of Justice has is an ideal that doesn't, in some cases, doesn't make too much contact with reality. And the Court of Justice is very strict in saying, well, we have this consumer image. Whether a consumer in an individual case had actual knowledge or was actually attentive doesn't really matter. There are few cases where inattentiveness is allowed. where that's understandable, yeah, in very specific situations. But generally, we don't look into that. We're looking into the average consumer. And taking these two things together, if we think about autonomy and protection, these two things cannot go together. They have different aims. So how do we square that circle and bring it together? Well, with some restrictions to autonomy, and currently that is done via competition law as well as consumer law, we restrict one party, for example, in saying if you are dominant in the market, you must not misuse that position. We allow you to be dominant, well, we can't do very much about that anyway, but you have to behave yourself, and you can't just take advantage of that, not too much advantage of that. Other measures could be restricting a party in selling certain things. Yeah, we protect underage young people from buying tobacco, alcohol, and so on, knives as well. All these measures are aimed to overcome imbalances and create autonomy in practice. So we do restrict autonomy to make it, to allow it to work in practice. So the idea is to create a level playing field between big business on one side and the little consumer on the other side. But this is all based on the assumption of the homo economicus, which is a rather selfish human being, looking after his own interests, rational and independent. Again, we think about our own shopping habits. We may be selfish. Are we rational? Are we independent? I don't think anybody can claim that we're not influenced by some form or shape of advertisement or presentation. Another matter to keep in mind, although we're looking at consumer contracts today, is that a lot of these issues apply to business to business as well as business to consumer relationships. In the current regulatory system, there is quite a lot of consumer regulation, and one might well say there's over-regulation. So often even well-intentioned businesses don't seem to be able to fulfill all the consumer legislation requirements without any flaws, even if they try hard. So there are flaws, there are problems with the existing regulation. And that is why the European Commission is very keen to address those and make it all better. There may be too much choice. If you, you can, due to age, think back to the times before the internet took off, there wasn't that much choice. It was all much easier. It is a great thing to have more choice, in a lot of respects, but sometimes it can also be bit of a pain, and too much choice can actually reduce the choice in reality consumers make out of that. Yeah? If there is this vast amount, are you really going to look into each and every corner? Probably not. If there is sort of a choice of five different things, you're much more likely to actually compare those. But that's something we can't change, that's just there, and we have to address what flows out of it. There is often lamented the lack of confidence in consumers, but the lack of confidence is certainly there in some cases, but more often I think the problem is actually overconfidence of consumers. In having the idea, oh, I've got all this choice, I've looked everything up, I've checked it, I've done my research, yeah, that's the very diligent consumer. So I am taking the right decision. And as we will see in a moment, that is not necessarily the case. So the consumer information approach leads to lack of information as well as information overload. Sometimes wrong information, and I don't mean information that's misleading or anything like that. It is true what is said, but it's not the information that actually matters to, or should matter, to take that choice. And information processing, and a bit more about that, and we look into behavioural economics. Behavioural economics analyse how consumers act in reality, rather than what any legislator also think how they might react. And the main findings, there's a lot more and a lot more detail on that, but the main issue is that there is a cost of information seeking. That can be time and money. Even if it's available for free, it's time that needs to be invested. And depending on what sort of purchase a consumer is thinking about, consumers have got an idea how much time they want to spend to find all these things out and to do their comparison. So that restricts the efforts that could be done. There are various different sources of information, observation and use, friends and families, advertising, marketing, advice from sellers, third parties, independent organisations, government, intermediaries, and so on. So there are various, there's sort of a whole bouquet of information out and different sources of information. And if you look at, into that list, you can easily imagine that some of them are more reliable, may get you the information you need to make a choice, others are less so. But they're all not objective, they're all not tailored to what this individual consumer wants. And therefore, even if you go to independent organisations, say look at which magazine or which website, where you find independent advice, then it doesn't tell you, and it can't tell you, whether these products you're looking at are actually suited for what you want to do with them, because they can't know. The information itself is flawed, according to behavioural economics, and I must say, I think they're right. The quality of information depends very much on the source, where it comes from, and even if we just look into honest traders and leave traders completely out of the picture, although of course they are a problem, we will have very different quality of information. Deception through information is perfectly possible. I will spare you embarrassing examples. If I will give you some examples of advertising, how many of you fall for it? I always do that with students, and they don't like it. Even in a situation where you are asked to think about it and where you're aware of what's going to happen, it is amazing how many are still deceived, depending on how it's presented. Interpretation of advertisements. Advertisements can't ever give you the full story, and then there would not be advertisements anymore, there wouldn't be advertising. So any claims in adverts may need some substantiation. The informational market power is affecting effective competition, where we're not just looking to price, but also the informational market. What do we know about products, about the quality of products, for example? So how are consumers taking decisions? Well, it's surprisingly simple. Although a lot of consumers, and especially well-educated consumers, think themselves into a situation that we're all quite rational and think about it and may do all sorts of things. But basically, when it comes to the crunch, it's the rule of thumb. Yeah? It looks right, is the right colour, whatever, and that's where we're going for. That often totally ignores possible choices, even if they're right in front of you. And it can be as simple as a colour or something like that. That another product that is there, presented, information, all there, is completely ignored. Consumers consider only a very limited number of variables. What matters about a product? What do we want it for? Should drive that, sometimes doesn't. A focus on price. I think we can all relate to that. And some attributes. So if you think of some new gadget that does something or other, then it has to have that function. Whether in other respects there are better products on the market don't really matter. Yeah? If a product has got a specific label, and a brand, that may draw intentions in there. And rounded up attributes, so attributes the consumer is not so focused on, will be hidden by the seller and often overcharged later on. So if you buy a printer, what interests is the price of the printer. It's a really good price. Possibly the quality of the printer. Yeah, things like whether it is black and white or colour, but how much the ink is or the toner. A cunning consumer, may even look into that question. But even that consumer will probably not be able to make a decent comparison because you don't know how much the bottle of ink or the toner cartridge costs, but you don't know how far you get with it, which is relevant for the price per page. More obvious and really annoying me are hotel rooms without breakfast. I can't function without breakfast, so how anybody can think of me wanting a hotel room without breakfast, I cannot imagine. And often you see a really good price for a hotel room, and the breakfast is about £20 for something that is certainly not worth £20, nor anything close to it. Often we have other uncertainties due to the product itself. If you think of insurance, for example, do we need that? Yeah. Do we need a specific protection or not? And that can be driven very much by advertising. The future use of the product by the consumer, what might you want to do with it later on? If there is an immediate use, that's something consumers can relate to. But can you use it? How do you use it in the future? Is often not considered. Qualities often are inherently uncertain. How long will it last? If it's a product that's just come on the market, there is no way to find out. Otherwise, what does it depend on? How much you use it? Or does it matter whether it stands around for some time, or does it have to be used all the time? Printer clogging up if you don't use it regularly. In the traditional theory, consumers are seen to maximize the expected utility. Behavioral economics say this traditional theory is an ideal construct. It doesn't make much contact with reality, and they've developed the so-called prospect theory, or reference-dependent loss aversion, which basically means that the consumer has got to focus on what's happening now rather than taking anything else into account. So trade-offs between consuming now or in the future, and there are interesting studies on how consumers react and trade off the future, or discounts for the future. The traditional theory assumes differentiation and discounting of the future because there are so many uncertainties. But the findings of behavioral economics tell us that many consumers treat the present as more important than other time periods. And that leads to so-called hyperbolic discounting. So you get 100 now or 150 next year. What do you go for? Most would go for 100 now, not wait, even if it's certain that this future event is going to happen. And not realizing that it's actually a 33% discount. Yeah, so no rational decision making at all. I think it will not be surprising to you that consumers are actually quite likely to take on debt and don't think into the future very much there either. Another finding is that consumers are likely to have self-control problems. I shall not comment more on that. Consumers are wedded to the status quo if there is more effort required for the future. So the status quo we're quite happy with, even if we claim we're not. And to make any changes for the future has always got uncertainties in it. But the research also showed that some consumers do focus on the shrouded attributes and benefit from lower prices. So if you look carefully into it, if you're clear in what you want the product for, that may give you a better price, and that means it can make the market work. And also, many consumers are affected by hyperbolic discounting, but clearly not all. So in a way, like we have with our current model, behavioral economics don't give us an answer what we can do. It is not the box that solves all problems. And we're still at the question, which consumer are we protecting? Are we protecting the most vulnerable consumer, which would then mean overprotecting everybody else? Or are we protecting a consumer who can look very well after himself, or somewhere in the middle, in which case we're sort of where the court of justice is with this average consumer. So how is behavioural economics used, and how should it be used? It is a fact that it is widespread used in business, and that is of great interest to businesses to tailor their marketing. Knowing how consumers make decisions means I know how to influence them. Yeah, and that's the trick of advertising. And if you think about lots of adverts, there is a very clear strategy. Yeah? Think of all adverts that are aimed at children to buy cars. They don't buy cars, and car producers know that. But children have got more and more a say in what car is going to be purchased. So we are confronted with a situation where behavioural economics are widespread used by business. In legislation, so far, it's only very occasionally used in very specific circumstances, but it is considered for the future. On the face of it, it would lead to equality of arms. So if businesses are using it, we use it in legislation as well, maybe that is achieving the equality of arms and putting the consumer into a better situation. It could also be used, and that is part of the Commission's agenda there, to nudge consumers into decisions which are in their best interest. I need to get the grammar right there. And the intentions there of the Commission are really very much in the consumer's interest. Use this to make consumers make retirement savings. In a lot of ways, I certainly don't disagree with any of their intentions at all, what they are trying to achieve there. If businesses use behavioural economics, they have got a competitive advantage. If we would use it in legislation, the hope would be, at least, that there would be better protection in reality rather than on paper, because at the moment, like we've seen in a lot of ways, we have quite a good protection on paper, but it doesn't make the contact with reality. That would be nice. But this also leads to a more paternalistic approach. Who decides what is right for consumers? That a certain retirement saving is what we should all be doing. Why do we not leave that to the market? And how do we use behavioural economics if we use it in legislation. Because we do risk restricting choice for consumers. We do restrict autonomy. And that, in effect, also leads to a split of consumer contract law with general contract law, which I think is problematic, because that would then also require that we'd have to have a separate set of consumer legislation that covers everything if we cannot rely on the general principles anymore. So the effects of using it in legislation, unless we use it for very, very specific points, is quite far-reaching. So is it for better or for worse to use it? On the better side, it gives better protection, especially for more vulnerable consumers. And I think there is no doubt about it. If we just don't allow certain things to happen, then nobody can suffer from them. It would mean legislation reacting to the use of these tools in business, and therefore a better chance to avoid imbalances, so we can address that and with the same tools. And it would give a better steer for consumers to avoid costs for the states in the future. If you think of insurance, retirement savings, that is obvious. So, like I said before, it's all really well intended. I don't have any issue with that bit. But on the worst side, there is a restriction of choice and lack of autonomy, and that is a general contract law principle. I'm quite wedded to. It will also lead to more reliance on the state. If the state is looking after all those things, then he needs to do it all round. Yeah? And there will be more reliance on the state, on the legislation. The state has to protect me. And that would mean more regulation. It would require a distinct consumer contract law, where essential contract law principles are not applied. And as a result of that, small and medium enterprises and consumers become more distinct than they are at the moment. And as an effect, the protection for small and medium enterprises would go down, unless we include them into consumers, but that is A, unlikely, and B, wouldn't be a good idea anyway. Decision making does not only happen in consumers, so why treat them differently? Decision making processes, I've shown you for consumers, happen the same way in institutions, in businesses, in taking their strategic decisions. It's just the way we work. And why shall we change that just for one bit? Yeah. If I go back one slide, there are arguments why we might want to do that. So, coming to my conclusion, where should we use it, or should we ban it altogether? No. We should use it to understand policy outcomes, legislation outcomes, better than we do at the moment, so to think about what does that mean in practice, is what we're trying to do there going to work, and that means we can also address the problems that show up with it and find some way of addressing it in some other way rather than just changing the legislation. One important conclusion to draw from it must be that more information does not mean better information. Yeah? The more information we give, the better the consumer is informed. No, it doesn't quite work like that. We need to get the information to the consumer, make it more focused. That could be done, for example, by default settings. Yeah, all these tick boxes and whatnot, if that is all geared up to protect the consumer, then we still give the consumer the right and the choice to opt out of it. But the default option, if the consumer doesn't care, will be very protective. Number of choices could be restricted, not in terms of number of products, but what you do with a product. Yeah, maybe just have a coffee of one size and not three sizes with whatever else. It could be used within the established contract law principles, allowing choice and autonomy, so keeping these principles, but that means don't use it to steer consumer behaviour. If we want to steer consumer behaviour, we may do that in other ways, or may use the results, but not in legislation. Basically, in the end, it comes down to the point to say the consumer has got a right to a wrong decision. If the consumer wants to make that decision, if we put them in a situation where it's not sort of guided into a wrong decision, and what may be wrong for one consumer could be right for another consumer, yeah, depending on what you want to do. Thank you very much.